Malvern Hill was an almost perfect military position. It was a gentle slope. Along the crest, the Federals packed infantry, they packed artillery, and then they had a spectacular vision in front of them, a very gentle slope up which the Confederate infantry would have to come if they were going to attack. It was the kind of position that generals dream of. McClellan put his army there, and they were in a splendid spot if they were going to have to fight off another series of Confederate attacks. Lee was frustrated by this point in the campaign. He had hoped to accomplish a great deal more. He'd seen his plans fail to be executed time and again. He'd seen lieutenants fail him. Now, part of the problem was that he was trying to do too much with an army that was still finding its way. It's a new army. Many of his subordinates didn't really have a record that suggested they could perform very well. And he didn't have a staff that was adequate to trying to coordinate some of the complex things he was trying to put in motion. But never mind all of that. The most important thing is, in my view, that Lee was frustrated. He thought that he'd missed opportunities, especially at Savage Station and elsewhere, and he meant to retrieve those at Malvern Hill and to rely on his infantry to do so. He decided to launch assaults against this strong Union position, and that's what he did on the afternoon of July 1st in the Battle of Malvern Hill. Again, poor coordination. Troops taking the wrong roads, taking a long time to get into position, delayed the assaults until about mid-afternoon. The Confederate artillery proved largely ineffective against the Union artillery at Malvern Hill, and in the end, the Confederate infantry attacked up the hill, unit after unit after unit, and they were easily driven back. They never really threatened the Union position at Malvern Hill. Daniel Harvey Hill, one of the Confederate division commanders and a soldier with an absolutely impeccable reputation as a tough combat officer, after the war wrote, and I think quite aptly, he wrote this of Malvern Hill. He said it was not war, it was murder. Just sending the infantry up and watching them be slaughtered. Many Northern officers recommended a quick counterattack after the failure of these Confederate assaults, but McClellan, who had spent the battle well to the rear, really not even in touch with what was going on, overruled that. He said, no, we're not going to do that. He was a thoroughly beaten man mentally, I believe. Others would disagree with that. But here he was in a splendid position, his army still very much intact, and having suffered far fewer casualties than they had inflicted, and he didn't have even a moment's thought of aggressive counterpunching. He was content to hunker down under the safe view of the Union Navy on the James River. Upon hearing of the order to retreat after Malvern Hill, McClellan decided he would drop down the James River a little bit farther to an even safer position at a place called Harrison's Landing. When he heard that the army was to retreat, a Union general named Philip Kearny is said to have remarked with disgust, "We ought, instead of retreating, to follow up the enemy and take Richmond. I say to all of you, such an order can only be prompted by cowardice or treason." That is Kearny's view of what McClellan was doing, retreating from this great position at Malvern Hill. But that was the end of the 7 days. Malvern Hill was a terrible decision on Lee's part. It would rank with the decision to assault Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg on the third day as one of Lee's worst. But McClellan retreated anyway. And let's move on now to talk for just a few minutes about the consequences of the 7 days battle and the 1862 Richmond campaign overall. The 7 days battle were the eastern equivalent of Shiloh in that they brought the new scale of fighting to both home fronts. Even more casualties here than there had been at Shiloh. 20,000 Confederate casualties during the 7 days. 16,000 Union casualties during the 7 days. A woman in Richmond named Sally Putnam, who left us one of the best accounts of life in Richmond during the war, described the horrors of the aftermath of the battle as thousands of wounded men poured into Richmond. She wrote, "We lived in one immense hospital and breathed the vapors of the charnel house. The weather was excessively hot. It was midsummer. Gangrene and erysipelas attacked the wounded and those who might have been cured of their wounds were cut down by disease. The diaries from Richmond are very graphic in what it meant to be close to the scene of a great Civil War battlefield. That's what had happened at the 7 days. So enormous casualties that show that the war is going in a very different direction. In a strategic sense, the initiative passed from McClellan to Lee. Lee had taken it from McClellan. The whole story in Richmond down to the 7 days battles had been, here come the Federals. They're coming at us up the peninsula. They're coming at us, or at least menacing us, from the direction of Fredericksburg. But now Lee has changed that dynamic. Now it's McClellan who's retreating away from Richmond, down the James River, and hunkering down along the river at Harrison's Landing. Lee is now in charge in that regard. Confederate morale rebounded remarkably after the 7 days. It's really quite astonishing how quickly it happened. It was almost as if all those bad things in the West hadn't happened. And Lee's own reputation did the same thing. All those doubts about him seemed to be swept away by the 7 days campaign. One of the Richmond papers that had been very hard on Lee when he first took command of the army, wondering whether he'd fight, wondering whether all he'd want to do is dig in, commented on this just a few days after Malvern Hill. It said that it couldn't remember another instance when the reputation of a general changed so dramatically. And the paper went on to say that, I guess we had basically, I'll paraphrase it, we just didn't understand what kind of General Lee was. Now we know. And now we have faith in him. We've seen that he will be aggressive. The European observers decided that the war was going the Confederacy's way after the 7 days. That really is quite an astounding fact, because it's as if they had blinders on for anything that happened west of the Appalachian Mountains. How could they cancel all of that good Union activity out west and decide the Union's losing the war just because of the 7 days? But many in the North took the same view. It frustrated Lincoln immensely. He poured out that frustration to the degree that he would pour things out in a letter. Writing to a French diplomat, he said, Lincoln did, he couldn't understand how all the good work of 6 months clearing 100,000 square miles of territory in the West should count for so little when a single half defeat, as Lincoln put it, that's how he termed the 7 days, should count for so much. But the fact was, it did. I think the most important outgrowth of this campaign was the emergence of Lee. It placed him in a position from which, over the next year, he would forge a record with his army that inspirited the Confederate people tremendously and made them resolutely look toward victory. They expected victory as long as Lee and his army were in the field. Lee and his army became almost exactly the equivalent of George Washington and the Continental Army during the American Revolution. And they would be the key factor in driving the Confederacy toward independence in the view of the Confederates. The next military phase of the conflict would see a major strategic offensive on the part of the Confederates, both in the Western theater and the East. In our next lecture, we will look at the Western component of that great counteroffensive.